Hey everyone, this is Mark Longhurst, your Living School Alumni Quarterly Editor, and I'm speaking today with 2018 Living School alumna Judy Grizzell. Judy is a neuroscientist specializing in addiction. She's a professor at Bucknell University, and she's written a recent book entitled Never Enough: The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. In this interview, Judy shares about her own journey as a recovering addict, what happens to the brain during addiction, and how the Living School shaped her process of writing the book. You'll notice, unfortunately, that there is some significant feedback throughout the interview. The content, I hope, is rich enough to make it worth your listen. Take care, everyone. Judith Grizzell is a neuroscientist, a 2018 graduate of the Living School, and has written a recent book entitled Never Enough: The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. So I wanted to thank you, Judy, for taking some time to speak with me and to the alumni community.
I'm happy to be here.
You are a neuroscientist professor at University of Bucknell, and you also share quite frankly in the book about your own journey as a recovering addict yourself. And so I wanted to start with your own journey and ask, how did the experience of being a former addict lead you to the experience of writing this book?
Well, I started, my first good drink was at 13. And for about 10 years, I took as much of every drug that I could get my hands on that I possibly could. And as a result of that, I was in pretty poor shape, you know, by the time I turned 23. And shortly after my 23rd birthday, I ended up in treatment, kind of by mistake. I didn't know exactly what I was getting into, and learned that there was this disease of addiction and that I had it, that if I had any hope of living, I needed to be abstinent. And well, like me, like most addicts, I think we are so determined. And so I thought at my ripe young age there, barely 23, don't tell me what I can do. I'm not going to quit using drugs. Drugs are the best thing in my life. They're really the only thing that gives me any solace at all. And so I somehow thought that I would solve the problem of addiction and then I would be able to use. And so this was kind of my back door, and it's testament to that tenacity of every drug addict rather than anything about me being strong or smart or anything. But I managed, after taking 7 years to get my undergraduate and 7 years in graduate school, to become a professor, to study the neuroscience of addiction. I do genetics and pharmacology. So I was about 30.
Wow. What a,
maybe a little longer.
Incredible journey that you used. The education was such a part of your way out of and into the recovery process.
Yeah, I kind of think addicts in general, and I'm one of these, are pretty extreme. And so if you would just say, you know, just say no, or, you know, can you just drink a little bit less, you know, and not end up wrapping cars around telephone poles or something, I think that's not possible. So I needed almost graduate school and university in general were a way to take my compulsive energy that was pretty powerful and use it for something that turned out, you know, not to be so destructive and maybe even constructive.
For those of us who are not familiar with what happens during addiction, what's going on in the brain that leads one to that experience of never enough?
Well, surely everyone is familiar with the physiological balances that we maintain, like our body temperature, which is kept at about 98.5 degrees. If we get too hot, we sweat. If we get too cold, we shiver. Losing heat or generating heat. Same with energy balances, water balance. Well, it turns out it's the same principle of homeostasis that drives the affective state or feeling state. And we if we try to feel, inflate our feeling state to feel really great all the time, which is what addictive drugs promise, we'll, you know, you'll feel better no matter what's going on. You're going to be on top of the world. And that is very compelling, but that doesn't work for the brain. The brain needs to have a baseline because it doesn't have a sort of stable set point of feeling, then it can't really tell what's going on. And so it closes that set point by counteracting any stimulus that changes your feeling state by taking cocaine regularly. You know, originally I felt really euphoric. Without cocaine, eventually I just felt very dysphoric, because the cocaine itself made life bearable. And I think maybe people can relate with their coffee habits. Drink coffee all the time. It no longer really makes you super peppy. It just makes you capable of getting through the day, where my body that's adapted to caffeine now is lethargic in the morning, difficult to put a sentence together. Can't really have a conversation or read a paragraph and focus until I get the coffee. So then the coffee makes me feel normal. And that tolerance and dependence due to the brain's adaptation is what makes addiction, really.
That's really interesting. And I didn't know about the adaptive process of the brain during addiction. And I'm wondering, if when one journeys into recovery, is the brain likewise adapting, and what does that adaptation look like when you're coming out of an addiction process?
Yeah, absolutely. So addiction is a process of the brain adapting to the drugs so that they have diminishing effects, so that you feel normal with them and terrible without them, and that sort of drives the vicious cycle. And recovery is a process of readapting the brain to the drug-free state. And so at first it feels absolutely miserable. I smoked marijuana as much as I could every day. And it got to the point where only by being stoned could I feel okay. When I wasn't high, the world was just bleak and empty and completely lacking meaning. It, of course, made me think, well, if I smoke weed, I'll feel better about this, which is the case really for every addiction. Opiate make you feel euphoric and block pain and suffering. It gets to the point where an opiate addict doesn't feel high at all. They just don't feel miserable if they keep using.
Is there any endpoint for the addictive process is the question.
Yeah. Well, the brain is an absolute master at adapting. I mean, it's got a lot of great qualities, but I think its finest quality is its ability to adapt to the environment. And so I don't think we'll find a way to outsmart, you know, all these years of evolution. And so the brain is always able to learn and to adapt. I think the net effect is you can keep raising the dose and taking the drug more and more, but essentially you're only trying to stave off the misery of withdrawal or the drug's absence. If you really wanted to experience the drug, you have to do it in an unadapted brain. And I think there's no way to, you know, get that except to cut off your head, you know. The yeah. Brain is so good at it.
This question is outside of your scientific field, but you are speaking to the alumni of the Living School. You are an alum of the Living School yourself. So what role does contemplation play in the addiction recovery process, and how have you engaged contemplation in your own work and in your own process?
Well, that's probably a new book, but I will say that the Living School played a really important role in the book. The book's been kind of in the works for about 10 years. And in a way, I just couldn't get myself out of the way to finish it. And it turned out, even though the original intent was to talk about some of my experience, that was really difficult to do compared to talking about the science, which I could do, you know, ad nauseum. So I had a friend who would say to me, okay, so contemplate and then write, and then contemplate and then write. But I didn't get that input until I got to the Living School. And I think my prayer, I don't think, my prayer as I realized that, wow, this book might actually see the light of day, became let this book come through me, let it be helpful, let me get out of the way so that the information and hopefully if there's any wisdom in there, that wisdom that is not of me could come out. And really until the very end, I was terrified. So I had to contemplate because I had no other way, since I don't use drugs, and I couldn't, you know, it's somebody like me. Contemplation is the first non-dead end I've tried, you know, the first strategy for living that has felt like it opens up my life rather than narrows it after a while. And I'm hoping there's some of the wisdom of all three of Cynthia and Jim and Richard in there, kind of embedded, which you might see. And I acknowledge the Living School and my circle cohort, who were amazingly supportive. But really, I felt like it was a kind of ground that I would return to when I got scared or over my head. I often felt like I was out on a limb. And I think, again, it wasn't so much science as it was kind of coming out as a recovering person, but more as an addicted person, because that's what I'm describing more in a professional setting. You know? And I really half hoped the book would, nobody would read it, and half hoped it would have an impact.
Thank you for sharing that experience. And what has it been like for you now on the other side of it, having come out and gone public with your story and the science and all of it?
Well, I still feel very much in the midst of it. I'm surprised that the book has had some success. I mean, some of it is just, I still cannot wrap my head around. It was picked up by Terry Gross, and on the way out of the Fresh Air Studios, they brought me by the book room, they call it, where they get about 300 books a week and pick two. And I can't understand how that could have happened, really. And it was a big help, obviously, to the book. And I'm hearing from a lot of people. I just talked to a guy this morning who's in his 80s who called me from Stockton, California to say it really helped him. And I hear from teenagers all the time and everybody in between. So we'll see if it has some helpful influence. It's such a terrible epidemic that I think anything is better than nothing. But I'm trying to hold on to my sitting practice very tight, because if anything, I need it more every day.
There's this quote from the Gospel of Thomas at the beginning of your chapter on alcohol, and you've got good chapter names, the sledgehammer alcohol, you call it. And then you have this quote, and if I can find it, I'm going to read it. It says, "I stood to my feet in the midst of the cosmos, appearing outwardly in flesh. I discovered that all were drunk and none were thirsty. And my soul ached for the children of humanity. For their hearts are blind and they cannot see from within. They have come into the cosmos empty and they're leaving it empty. At the moment you are inebriated, but free from the effects of wine, you too may turn and stand." And so as a Living School alum myself, I read that and immediately noticed the work of contemplation and the work of contemplative texts. And I wondered, what is it to be inebriated in the spirit, but free from the effects of wine for you, and why did you begin that chapter with that quote?
Well, I first heard that in my first day, I think, at the Living School, and I was sitting on the floor, and Cynthia was sharing, and we read that and talked about it, and it spoke to me so much because I think that for me, alcohol and drugs were such a tool for trying to escape reality and escape my existence and escape the pain of living and not knowing. I guess the pain of the mystery, the pain of what seems like distance, the pain of all my illusions. I mean, I felt like I just wanted to blot that out. And really, from my very first drink, that was my goal. And I, you know, it was basically a death wish. And I think what that speaks so much to that part of me that couldn't bear to live. And also, it holds out this bit of hope about what it would be to stand in my shoes and take my place in the cosmos as a child of God, as someone who's meant to be here, and you know, able to hold, I guess, the incredible beauty and the incredible terror of living. And that's something that I hadn't really heard articulated so well. And it's, you know, a beautiful idea.
I think that's a good one to end our conversation on, and with the hopes that all of us listening may have the courage to stand in the cosmos with our feet on the ground, with the terror and the beauty of living. So may it be so. And thank you again for taking the time to speak with me and with us.
Thanks, Mark.